Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 204, which is my last of the THU episodes that I recorded, Trojan Horse with a Unicorn. This was a panel at THU that I recorded back in September. The subject of the panel was artificial intelligence, and I had some amazing people on the panel, including Sabim Engelhardt and Alexander Mankowski, who both come from Daimler and do some really interesting work over at Daimler, Jeff Kember at Google, Scott Eaton, who's an incredible artist doing research in the field of machine learning for his own art, and Rob Hoffman from Lenovo, who is obviously Lenovo is a hardware company, do a lot of artificial intelligence machine learning work as well. And then Paul Debevic appears every now and then in the audience and contributes wonderfully to the conversation, as Paul always does, and Paul is at Google. I'm going to give it more details in the introduction when I introduce the actual panel, so I'm not going to get too deep into it because I don't want to be redundant. But it was a really fascinating panel and got very heated, and I really, really appreciate it. I will note that it gets a little loud about halfway through because the VR battles were happening next door to us around midnight. So hopefully you guys will be okay with it. It was a really wonderful to have this this panel happen and to have such a great conversation with such great contributors. I don't really have any big announcements. V-Ray for Houdini, the new beta is out for that, so go check that out if you're into V-Ray for Houdini. We did write an amazing blog post with Grant Miller from Ingenuity Studios about the work that they did using V-Ray for Houdini for The Walking Dead. We call it Invasion of the Body Crashers, so go check out the blog post. So just go to chaosgroup.com and check out the work that they did with that software if you're interested. And besides that, this podcast is coming out on Christmas Eve. For those of you who celebrate Christmas, I wish you all a Merry Christmas. Everyone, I also wish you a happy 2019. I am very much looking forward to 2019. I think it's going to be a very interesting year. We are looking forward to some very interesting work that we're doing in that area. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. And hopefully you enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for coming to the last of the technology and creativity talks that I've been doing. This is new. This is new for you, and new for me, and new for THU. How many of you guys have been to the other two talks that were here? Oh, shit, you guys really like this. Okay, good. All right,
customers.
Great. Thanks so much for being here. This is awesome. I think this has been a really good addition. How many of you guys enjoyed this as an addition to THU to talk about technology? And by claps, not by hands. Thank you. Thank you so much, because this is an audio thing. This is also going to be on the CG Garage podcast, and if any of you guys, how many of you guys listen to the CG Garage podcast by claps? All right. This is a thing that's very passionate to me. This is what I do. I have the freedom to do this. Peter Mitev is in here in the audience, and I want him to know that this is something that is important to the community and important to what we do, and I love to do this. Thank you, Peter, for making me happy. This is my fifth THU. I'm a veteran. I love this. I love being here. I love doing what I do, and I love being part of a creative person and being a technology person. And when Andre told me that he wanted to find a way to make technology work at THU, it was a very interesting conversation to have, because he specifically designed THU as a way to get away from the technology conversation, because the technology conversation has always revolved around, let's say, corporate interests, right? And this is not what we do. We use technology as artists. We all use technology, but we don't use it as corporate interests. We use it as a personal interest. And I want to try to find a way to bridge that gap between, you know, technology and the artist, and make that gap smaller, and figure out a way to have a conversation about that. And some of that is controversial, which I know tonight will be a big one in that realm, because tonight we're going to talk about artificial intelligence. This has been in the news for a long time, and there is a role that we have in a world of AI, machine learning, and creativity. And that is what this conversation is going to be about today. So thank you so much for coming for that. With that being said, we have a very diverse group tonight to talk about this subject. They're coming from all over the place. So please, first, let's welcome Sabine for being here. And she works for Daimler. Sabine is a scent designer. Scent designer. I mean, when was the last time that you had someone at THU as a scent designer? I mean, that is amazing. Yeah. And Sabine uses AI as an influence into her own technology. Am I right?
No.
No, you don't? You don't?
No.
What do you use?
For the scent design, is really is about storytelling, creativity, finding words, and there is no AI. There is maybe in the whole process when a perfume is created, there is maybe something like this or can be add-on, but not in the first part where you tell a story and give it to a perfumer who made a perfume out of it. This is just words and no AI.
So, but she can tell you, because we're working together, she is always, she's a kind of in the forefront to smash these people back who tell you, to tell you that you are just models out of numbers and everything can be measured. And then we see your emotions like this, and when we give you more scent or less scent, yeah, to this mechanical view, she's always fighting against that, and have more holistic view. No? So that's her position to AI.
Well, thank you, Alexander. Alexander here is a futurist, also working at Daimler, and you have thought about the world in the future.
Yeah, sure.
And the past.
Yeah, sure.
Because you can't have the future without the past. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, all in all, it's about giving impulses into the company. Yeah, for example, these autonomous car stuff. Yeah, this is I started this in 2007, I think. Yeah, pushed the company, say, okay, you build mobile robots in the future. No, nobody loved that. Oh no, very few people loved that. And I say, okay, stay away from the steering wheel, get it away, and so on. And impulses like that, yeah. And in 2015, then we had at the company Mercedes, and we had it to at a display a autonomous car of the future, how it could look like. Yeah, at communi, it was an experimental thing to could communicate to the outside, to the people, yeah, that they should understand the car like that, yeah. And doing this stuff is very nice in the company, because you have leverage, because it's a large company. Maybe it's not a digital domain at all. No? It's just partly because of real things. Yeah, but that's a task. Yeah, impulses, and what I'm working now on is more with architectural companies to display city of the future. Yeah, which should be desirable. Yeah, for everybody, and for blueprint cities and also for existing ones. Yeah, that's a kind of a work in progress to give us images. Us means everybody to discuss that about internally in the company too, to give us images, visions. Maybe that's a reason I'm here. Images, yeah, you are good in images, obviously, and yeah, to get make it accessible, yeah, the future to discuss it and do it.
Yeah, thank you, Alexander. That's very interesting, and I'm sure we're going to get a very good discussion with you, especially with this guy over here, Jeff. Jeff works over at Google, and I've actually worked with Jeff on a lot of little projects or bigger projects. But either way, Jeff had, how many of you guys have seen Jeff's presentation today? A couple of, okay.
Thank you for coming.
Jeff has a very specific look at what AI is going to offer to the future, especially in the world of this very specific type of technology. So Jeff, go ahead and tell them a little bit about what you do.
Sure. I'm the technical director for media for Google Cloud Platform. So worked in the film and game industry for a long time, left production and moved over to Google. I had the opportunity to, what I thought was an opportunity, and it's turning out that way, which I'm happy about, is to try and change a little bit how the industry works. So it's been a fixed bid. Here's a storyboard and here's some animatics and go solution. And instead, we wanted to be able to try and see if there is a way to enable artists to be able to be distributed anywhere on the planet and be able to have, you know, editorial in Tokyo and have artists working in Frankfurt and Helsinki as well as in Cape Town and mash all that together. And of course, the fantasy of laptop on the island, right? I mean, here we are in Malta. The connectivity is great. There's no reason you couldn't do production work here. And so the idea of democratizing it and decentralizing it and making it accessible to people so that, you know, the most talented artists would be able to compete on a global scale. And that's really what the technology enables. And that's everything from the global network through to the GPU and compute options that we offer. But most importantly, for tonight's conversation, the machine learning technologies that are, you know, becoming available. The open source TensorFlow, as well as the APIs that are built, enable artists to be able to do things in different ways and hopefully be elevated from some of the mundane tasks and be able to spend a little more time not learning how to juggle or not watching grass grow, but instead can actually be more creative and effective.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jeff. That was great. At the same time, you've got someone like Scott here, who is a veteran of THU, because you've been here last year, right? And he's an amazing artist. How many of you guys know Scott, you know, came to see any of his talks? Yeah, great. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
And Scott has been studying anatomy for a long time. You guys know this. I mean, he is like my anatomy guy. If I need any questions about anatomy, he does that. But what he also does is he studies technology a great deal. And what he's done that amazing thing where I always say that, like, my superpower is that I have a big Rolodex and I take two cards out of the Rolodex and I try to see how they stick together, right? Like what he does. And what he does is he's like, he takes his anatomy card and he takes his technology card and he tries to stick them together and sees how he can do something amazing with that. And discovers amazing new worlds with this thing, specifically in terms of AI and anatomy, which is incredible. So Scott, tell us a little bit about what you do.
Good question. Probably backstory is in order, but maybe too much for what's going on here. But I was at the MIT Media Lab probably nearly 20 years ago now, and that kind of. It was in my transition into visual effects. I spent 10 years in production, maybe before a little bit visual effects. It was 2 years in Florence studying sculpture and drawing, like very traditional, rigorous academic training, and then technical direction in visual effects, and then creature supervision. So for me, I've always tried to balance the two halves of my brain, which is always quite technical, math and science directed, and then also a passion for art. And for me, initially, well, for the majority of my career, it was visual effects satisfied those two things. I left visual effects maybe 6 years ago, full time, and started to do independent projects, self-directed projects, and about 2 years ago, I started to experiment with some of the machine learning algorithms that were being published, and initially got some improbable results, like things that, you know, as an experienced digital artist, make you scratch your head, like, how is this possible? Because it is a black box. And so you control the inputs and you look at the output and you're like, Jesus, how did that happen? And it's amazing. And so it was probably 2 years ago that I started going down the rabbit hole of deep learning in regards to image creation and art creation. And that's where I'm at now. I just have been in the studio cooking machine learning models on my GPUs nonstop for months and years. Well, I don't want to say years yet because it's still not years, but my heating bill has gone down because it depends where you say the heat comes from, but it comes from my GPUs right now. So that's where I'm at, and trying to make images and it's as compelling as ever. So I hope I can like maybe say some things that will not be bleak about AI in the future, but be like exciting because it's amazing, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, Scott. I mean, it's hard to explain what Scott does unless you see it, and you know, if you guys dedicated because you're here at 11:30 at night, and so all of you are privileged to go talk to Scott and say, show me. I'm giving that to them.
It's really good.
I mean, it's fantastic. It's really hard to, how many of you guys have gone home and tried to explain THU to your friends? And how many of you guys have just succeeded in doing that? Right? Yeah, it's hard to explain, right? What Scott's doing is like THU. It's hard to explain how amazing this is. And the thing that's exciting to me is I even saw it in Scott's face is, oh, he's getting excited because he's discovering things in his own world that he's doing. I highly recommend you guys to go see Scott's work, which at some point has to go live on the internet at some point, right?
It will, but it's... We'll talk about it.
Okay, but that work is amazing, and I'm very excited about it, and that is why he's here, because he was not on the panel, and then when he showed this to me, and he's like, you gotta be on the panel. All right, and then last, but certainly not least, is Rob Hoppin. Thank you, Rob, for coming here.
Thank you.
Rob is from Lenovo. We guys know how much love we have for Lenovo here at THU. Thank you for Rob and Lenovo being here.
Thank you very much.
I happen to be, because of my THU relationship, I happen to be, you know, on the advisory council at Lenovo because, you know, they want to know how, you know, our stuff works with there. And he's cool. He's like, I want you on this panel and stuff. And I got to see, you know, a little bit behind the curtain. It's like, you know, seeing what they're doing. And they're doing some really interesting work and using their hardware to really consider what people are doing in AI. And what they're doing in AI to help AI, and especially in that world, is really great. So I definitely thought that, you know, Rob needed to be invited into this thing and think about how he's going to help people figure out what AI, what they can do with AI with their hardware. So thank you so much for being here, Rob.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so here we are now, and I am going to ask you guys a little bit, and all I want is some questions. I don't want elaborate questions. I want, like, short questions. What is, and I'm going to walk around the room. Screw it. Let's do this. Walk around the room. What is your fear or hope of AI?
And my fear is if it will take over, like, the creative part of the whole process of making art. Like, if it will take off, like, do we even need to think anymore, in a way? In a big part, yeah.
And what is your hope of AI?
It's about it will make my life easier.
Okay, that's perfect. All right, what about you?
fear, I don't have any fear, I think, about it. And I think in terms of hope, probably a great problem-solving tool for the future, because of all the power of understanding different scenarios, making all the calculation that it can make. And yeah, I'll save
it. It's good. Okay, what about you?
Fear? I'll go with analyzing large amounts of data to make decisions that can impact the world, and the same for the hope. So I know for the work we do with virtual reality, simulating the people that you're talking to in those experiences is something I'm really excited about. That
doesn't sound like a fear. That sounds like a hope.
Well, I'm a very optimistic person, so. I would say, with the work we do, that's one of the things I'm most excited about.
All right. So there's definitely this, like, is it going to take over my job, or is it going to make my job easier, right? That's the thing that's been going around. Now, I'm sure you guys already know my angle on this, but don't let go of that fear. That fear is real. That fear is something that we need to think about. Like what we think about in terms of what AI is, you know, we have been ingrained in fear of AI, right? From 2001 with HAL 9000, you know, Terminator, all of this is based on fear. Fear of AI, fear of what it does. How many of you guys have seen the movie Moon? Good count. Do you guys remember the robot on Moon? Yeah? Okay, Paul, tell me about the robot on Moon.
I think he's part of the Me Too movement now. Unfortunately. But back then, he was a benevolent, helpful robot, and that was part of the idea of the movie. He's just kind of an anti-HAL.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, he had something interesting. It was called empathy, right? And the we have been taught by technology that computers are binary. They can't make any emotional decisions. They only make a binary decision because we were taught that it's an if-then computer, right? It's an if this happens and that happens or else this happens, right? So that's all we were taught. And so therefore, computers only said logical choice left, logical choice right, right? They didn't make any other thing. That's actually not right. Computers actually can think in that way through an AI system, right? Empathy is a taught process. And you can teach a computer empathy in the same way. And that's what they saw on Moon, right? They saw empathy. So they're able to teach empathy to computers. That doesn't mean that they want to destroy us. That means that they will empathize with us and they want to help us, right? So computers have the ability to do that, and we can teach them that process. And this is a very complicated thing to think about. So that being said, I'm going to throw it back at my panel here.
Yeah. You are fantasizing.
Ah. Go ahead, Alexander.
Yeah, it's a...
Or define empathy.
Yeah, define empathy. Yeah.
Define empathy?
Yes.
Yeah, try it.
I define empathy as being able to mirror my emotions.
To mirror your emotions. Okay, define emotion.
I feel like it's late and I'm tired.
Yeah.
It's 11:30 at night.
So and
Andre made me do these panels so late.
Say, yeah, now we are on the right path. And the tiredness, you feel them in your feet maybe and in your skin and so on, huh? Yeah. Yeah. Teach that a computer.
Well,
without any skin. Yeah, it has no skin. It has no feet. It can't replicate your body. How does it work? How does it work? There are many hypotheses.
But you can look at me.
Wait.
Can you look at me?
Yeah, sure.
Of course you can. Can a computer look at me?
No.
Yes, it can.
No, it cannot. Well, I explain it to you. Explain it. I can. A computer has only cameras and it cannot look at you. It can sense you. It can get some data points, images in it, and then it can compute the images, everything. But it's not looking at you. No.
I work for a ray tracing company.
Yeah.
And we trace rays of light.
Yeah, yeah.
And therefore, the only thing that my eyes do is to see light.
Yeah, that's very, very, very old-fashioned. This definition.
Okay.
Yeah, you have your perception. Our perception.
But if I saw you on Skype video.
Yeah. Wait. Our perception. What is the current hypothesis about perception? Yes, it's only hypothesis. It's not everything. It's totally clear. But the current hypothesis about perception is that our perception in itself is very autonomous. Yeah, we have no access, no conscious access on perception. So what is our perception? What is it doing? For example, if now a mouse would run here over the carpet, everybody would see the mouse. Why? Huh? Yeah, why? Because it's alive, and our perception is tuned to find things which are alive. Yeah, I would have to have an intention like that. So a perception.
How did
way,
you see that mouse?
My perception would look for living things. Wait a little bit. I'll stop it immediately. But the hypothesis of this perception, the empathy stuff, is that I see yourself and I replicate yourself while watching you, your body movement in myself, and then if the feeling emerges in me, how you feel, how I would feel if I took it this way. So you need a body for that. You need experience for that. You need a past for that. You need to be developed as a child for yet, as a baby for that. You need all this ontogenesis, all your genesis as a complete human being to see, like the gangsters say, to feel each other. Huh? They're right. And that's empathy. That's the current hypothesis on empathy.
Okay.
Let's stop.
So you're saying that
without being a baby, you can't do it.
I agree with that.
Huh?
I agree with that.
You agree with that, Scott?
I agree that in.
So you're saying vision.
I agree with his definition of empathy. That having embodiment, having experience, having the awareness of what someone else is feeling requires that you've felt or you can remember feeling that in the past.
And I
do not think that we can ascribe empathy to AI at this point.
Experience. Now define experience.
Do it over and over and over again till I learn.
Let's
talk about birth.
No, stop. Yeah, stop. Experience. What is experience? If you have you children? Do you have children?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Then once you have a child, maybe 1 year old or something like that, and it learns words, yeah, and it sees a bird first time, and the name bird comes up. This one, bird. Yeah. Once this happens, the concept of bird is there. It will recognize every bird, any bird which is irgendwie bird-like. It's one view. It will try to fly, yeah, like a bird. Everybody tries, does not work. And that's experience. It's experience, and afterwards it's trying to build it with a body and so on. And so that's an experience that has nothing to do with the training and machine network. But I mean, this is something else.
Okay, hold on. We got a question, Alexander. Hold on.
Yeah.
I think, like, if you think about neural networks, right? Mm. They are kind of trying to model how the human brain works.
No. There was once a neuroscientist. This was totally funny. It was a totally funny guy. He said he comes on a scene stage, and he said he showed some pictures of neural networks. There were always these neurons and the empty spaces in between. Yeah, all these neurons connecting to each other. And then he laughed out loud and said, "Okay, the brain is the densest thing in the known to man. Yeah, the densest package, and it's not about neurons connected like that. Yeah, but you can read that yourself." It is not logic or mathematics in biological form. It's much more difficult. It's called neural networks, but it's just a name dropping.
Jeff, you're probably the best person on the panel right here to answer. And I'm putting you on a freaking spot, I know that. But seriously, Jeff, think about what that means. Like, I agree with you, Alexander. I don't think that the neural network is really just put there to make people freak out that they're making a human brain on the computer. It's not. It is just layers. It's just layers.
It's a very cool thing. You know that.
But go ahead. Define what a neural network is. Can you do that for this audience? Because I know Jeff is going to have a hard time, so this is going to be a good one.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for that. Yeah. So.
That's difficult.
Yeah, it's a challenging construct. I described it today in terms of training neural networks, in terms of being able to have a variety of inputs, and then having a graph that would then execute, and then getting some known outputs from that. So there's a training step to it, and then there's an actual execution step to it. So when I work with people, we'll tend to have a conversation about, let's look at the training set you wish to. What is the output you're looking for? And it really comes down to whether it's a supervised or unsupervised or semi-supervised learning situation. So forgive the roundabout response here, but the way I tend to deal with it is, let's talk about the content we want to work with and tagging it and such, and then training a network and then being able to execute that network on a much larger, broader, more broad body of work. From an artistic standpoint,
okay,
I'm trying to give
it is a network.
Yes.
It absolutely is a network. Whether it's a neural network is...
Well, I can have a stab at this.
Go ahead,
right?
Go ahead, Scott.
So at the fundamental level, it's like the neural network is an analogy to how a neuron fires and activates. So you have an activation potential or something like that, and it either turns on or off when it gets above a certain threshold. So a neural network, like the atom, the neuron, is a unit. It has multiple inputs potentially coming in, and it weights them based on a guess to start with, and it sends an output out. A simple neural network is one neuron, some inputs coming in, one coming out. You check the output and see how wrong it is, and then you go back in, and those weights on the input effectively adjust. So that's what's called the back propagation step. So you measure how wrong it is. You filter a little correction back. It corrects the multiplies of the inputs and gets you closer to a thing that will process the inputs to match your intended output. Okay, that with one unit, but the sophistication comes when you have a layer that can process many inputs, and that's a shallow neural network if you have one layer. As you start to stack these, the output of one network starts to interconnect with the inputs of the next network, and then you have a two-layer network, and then you're back propagating smaller chunks through the chain, and it just does these small updates on the weights. And then you string these together, and eventually you have what's called a deep neural network, which is stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of parameters that are being updated with every pass through the data. So you're passing in inputs, you're comparing them against the expected output, the ground truth, and that's the training process. If it's off, you back propagate the error, and it does little updates that cascade back through the nodes, kind of the little multiplies, and then you do it again. And then you do it again, and luckily you're not doing it, some of the computers do it, because you do it millions of times, and some of the networks I train, 67 million parameters, so you get a size of the depth of it, like all these little, you know, floating point numbers.
Yep.
Just kind of cranking away on images, and eventually there's so many parameters in the depth of this network that you can't really very well inspect what any small local region does. And so, in my experience, you're left with more or less a black box. And this is a little bit of a problem in AI, is that you have these things that are making decisions, and sometimes, depending on how you train them, there's biases that are undiscovered in the network, like driving a self-driving car and it does really well, except for that time that it saw one image that causes it to go right into a pedestrian, like an exception that's somewhere in there, and the only way you can do it is to test it, right? And this is a thing. I think the EU actually has a rule, a legislation that, what is it called? It's called, it slips my mind, but
it has to be explained.
Explicable. Yeah, so there's a big push on that, because effectively that's what happens, is you get something super deep and it does something amazing, but you can't really tell how it does it. And that's my two cent explanation.
Yes, and for the audience here, I think what you explained is a very complex system of balance, right? Because you explained the fact that things are based on what is called weight, right? And weight is a variable. I'm just going down to the basic things, right? Weight is a variable. It can be heavier or lighter, right?
Yeah. One and, or 0.3 or 0.5,
right.
Or 2.5s, I mean, you're doing half and half of the two inputs. I mean, it's simple. And that's the thing, it's like super simple, but super simple times a lot.
But the fact is,
it becomes complex.
Weight is not a Boolean. And people thought of computers as Booleans, where there's like zero or one, right? Because we still like say zero or one. Computers only know in zero and ones. They don't. They actually do understand in between states. And the fact that you brought up the term bias is an extraordinarily important thing to talk about, because this is what Alexander is talking about. It's like, bias can be introduced into a system where it can't actually figure out real emotion because there's bias involved. Am I right?
I wouldn't agree to this wording. No, no. The bias thing is that you have that you try to recognize somebody, yeah, and it happens that you have always blue shoes in the picture, and then the blue somehow it happens that the thing will then label this carpet, which is blue, as a person, yeah, like that. It would be very awful, yeah, for a car, for example, automotive car. So you need always a kind of emergency shell around that. Emergency shell means a radar, for example, that says, okay, this is a person, even if the system has decided, okay, this is whatsoever, just a sheet of paper. So you need always to make a frame these machine learning system, yeah, to frame it with something else as an emergency system, and then make your decisions in a traditional if then else or mathematically clear, and because of the law, yeah, you have to define why has the car behaved like that, and this is then the planning system. This is separated.
Chris, can I say about bias? So yeah. To correct about bias, like bias is when you have your input data, you're grabbing whatever you want to feed into the neural network, right? Say, for example, I wanted to train something that would identify something that's artwork, right? And so you would feed it a bunch of images of, say, just pictures. If you sample a set of pictures and say, that's not art, and then you get everything off the front page of ArtStation, and you say, that's art, you know, ArtStation, and you run it through, and it can reliably predict what's art, being ArtStation, but if you feed it a picture of a Rembrandt, it would say it's not art, because it's biased by your selection of the data set, right? That's the bias. The bias is kind of inherent.
We talked about that in the bus, I think.
It's just in general principle, like that's what bias is. Yeah. It's a bias in your selection of your data set, right? In the stuff that I do, I'm incredible. In general, Like when you're developing a tool that you're deploying worldwide, you don't want any bias. You want it to be as unbiased as possible. You don't want it to favor men over women, any particular race or nationality over another in your search responses, for example. So you need to have it bias neutral if you can.
Grayson has a question. Okay, well, Grayson.
The question on the board, will artificial intelligence replace you? I think is really important to address. So if maybe we could kind of steer it a little bit.
Obviously, a lot of you guys have thought about the fact that there is a lot of AI that's been out there that has created art, let's just say. What is your opinion about the fact that computers can create art? I'm going to go around the audience here. I'm going to go to this girl right here.
I don't really know what you mean by art, because there are some, even some like abstract paintings, definition human problem. Paintings that I don't even understand. So I guess that concept is really abstract. Maybe a robot can paint like anything, make, and it will be considered art just because it was a robot who made it. But I don't know.
That's an excellent way to phrase it, because what you've just said is abstract art, right? So something that comes out of imagination, it comes out of something other, right? So the fact is that a computer can only do or make from what it knows, right? So it only can build from the past. Am I correct?
Yes. I think a lot of it has to do
go
with...
Go ahead, Rob.
A computer, well, any type of art, and I use that term very loosely, created by a computer by itself, it doesn't have soul. I mean, no. It doesn't have... It has what somebody else has asked it to do. That's what it's producing.
So, right.
When you say soul, it doesn't have intention.
That's
what makes
that's a better way of putting it. Yeah.
Intention.
To make it to be the bias thing, yeah. What is very useful in these machine learning stuff, and to say, okay, I fed it with, if it's individually, I fed it or we fed it with, obviously this and this material, it can work as a function as a mirror, like in therapy, yeah. You can see. That's a nice thing about this kind. You have. You can use it as a collective, a mirror for collectivity or for yourself, yeah? Because you can yourself think art is for me or good taste is for me, everything is white and black, yeah? You wouldn't say that because it's a little bit pathetic, yeah? But maybe it is the case, yeah? And so if you feed the system with that, then it will end up displaying you. There was an art in cyber arts, yeah? There are many, many artists are working with this. And one guy, he made a chatbot, yeah? And fed it with all his chats, yeah? So, amounts of chat, yeah? And then the answer was always, okay, like that, very short. And then he asked his friends, because he was so frustrated, and he said, that's you. Yeah? You are so short. So it can work as a mirror. This is very.
So you're saying you're not going to get an overly effusive, verbose chatbot if you are a concise, terse individual. Mm. Is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a mirror to the data set you put into it.
Yeah, the mirror. It's a mirror. Yes. That's a fine thing because you can learn from that mirror. Yeah. Even if the result is maybe not satisfying, you don't like that. It's a good thing. You can learn from that. You can use it as a learning tool to mirror yourself or mirror society also.
But isn't bias, bias is basically garbage in, garbage out, right? That's the thing, right? It's like you feed it a bunch of, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I'll respond to the question, but I have a follow-up if I could. So I'm going to say, researchers I've worked with who've gone and trained a data, if they have a specific data set they're working with and they have a specific output in mind, there's a use case for the model, because you don't need to go and train a model to do everything. You need to train a model to do the specific thing you want it to do. And they're very effective in doing that. But if you, as soon as you try and take that graph and then the input data and take it somewhere else and then add extra things to it, you can quickly run into a problem of, although that was efficient time-wise for you at the second user, but you can end up with all the built-in bias from the previous data set. So we often encourage people to say, great, if you want to reuse the graph, that's fine, you can reuse the neural net, but we're going to go through and train it with different data. The question I was going to ask is, would it help if we took the phrase on the screen and put a time scale to it? And the reason I ask is, for me personally, I'm not a futurist. I'm not thinking 50 years in the future or however far you're able, you know, how many decades or eons you're thinking. Professionally, I tend to think more in kind of the 12 to 18 month time scale because you know, people ask me, what is it going to be like in 5 years? And I said, well, I'm not sure what it's going to be like in 2 years, if that. So from the replacement standpoint, did you perhaps want to put a time scale on the question?
In terms of what the life of the artist will be?
Well, will machine learning replace you in the next so many years? Yeah. 6 months? Yeah, 2 years?
No.
10 years?
Okay, that's
100
years? That's a fair question. The question is, where will machine... Okay. There was two questions that brought up at the beginning of this. Was one is the fear that the computer will replace you. The second one was... it will make my life easier, right? And I know that people here are not trying to actually replace everyone's jobs here, right? They're trying to make a different situation happen. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what things are happening in artificial intelligence right now that are actually trying to help the situation to make their jobs easier.
Okay, well, back to definitions briefly. So I'll say machine learning is a branch of artificial intelligence. Great. And then I'll say...
what's the other branch?
Well, there are many, exactly. And so as soon as we delve into reinforcement learning and general purpose artificial intelligence and things that I don't work with, which are awesome and I'm excited about the opportunities that exist in those spaces. I work primarily on the machine learning side and I work with TensorFlow. So in that context, it's that subset. You know, I should have a t-shirt on that says label all the things. Label them. And in that context, artists can be empowered in terms of being able to say they need to find some content so they have a multi-decade archive, and they're able to traipse through it, and through different machine learning techniques and technologies, different APIs, open source, open CV, all sorts of goodness, they can say, I want to find a picture that was shot in New Guinea, but I want to be able to look at other pictures that were shot in the same area, but I want to change the decades in which they were shot, and I want to change, there's a picture of this animal or these people, I want to find other people similar to that. So there's just... if you think of someone from an editorial context who needs to be able to produce a specific type of image, but it's perhaps more of an emotional question in terms of, I'd like to produce an image that makes me feel a certain way because they want to tie it into a story, and they've already written the story, they want a picture to go with it. Machine learning could help in terms of a media asset management system, in terms of being able to traipse through the archive and give that artist the ability to get an image they want.
So what you just described was not necessarily the work that an artist does, but the work that an art director does.
Correct. Yes. I'm trying to be broad on that definition, but...
okay, hold on. This person has a question.
You want to stay with creators, yes?
So the thing, I've seen it's coming a lot of new AI technology out there, especially with Google, coming out with their kind of neural network learning art stuff, where they can actually, you can draw an outline of something, and it'll find out what it is, and it will find pictures on the internet, and it will kind of replace stuff. Mm-hmm. So it kind of make, if you draw a cat, it will basically make a cat.
Yes.
Your little sweet outline. So my question kind of comes over to the whole thing about, would it ever take that part of yourself, the only thing you do is basically making an outline, and it will create the whole beautiful thing itself?
I think Scott needs to answer that question.
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, no, because...
There's some really interesting work that's out there right now, and one of the early demos that you described is something called image-to-image translation, And it can be anything, right? In that context, it's draw an outline and fill it with something. Other examples, you have a black and white photo, and you've trained a neural network on, you know, black and white pair, black and white photo and color photo pairs, and you just give it tons of black and white photos and colors in pairs, and it learns to colorize photos quite reliably. Other examples are like removing noise from like renders especially, or like really high ISO photos. You give it noisy image, you give it clean image, and it learns a correspondence, and essentially it transfers between the domains, and in effect that link, what I've described to you, like noisy image, clean image, that's a very straightforward, is the same domain, right? The interesting creative possibilities are when you transfer between domains, right? Still working in image space, right? You're still working between images, and you know, I that's kind of the space that I'm exploring, and it's quite, there's a lot of creative possibilities, because it's just I can't explain it with words, but these things that we're making are tools, and there's right now there's no fear involved, right? Like when I render something in whatever my render is and is gone for 10 seconds and is really noisy, I'd be like, you know, I can wait for another 20 minutes and have a clean image, or I can say, AI, clean it up, and it looks pretty effing good, and that makes me happy, right? I'm not fearful for my job, it just lets me get on with iteration and making things better.
But you have to, absolutely, go ahead,
maybe, Matt. Maybe you have to think back when photography was invented, yeah? This put many people out of the job who has just stupidly, in a way, or jump just as an, or just to my portraits, yeah, like that. Maybe that was the photography then. Photography was then better, cheaper, easier, and so on. So you have, if you, but that's in very, in the end, it's a very old truth. You have to develop your job if you have new tools. But, or the other thing was, photography was one thing. The other thing was the reproduction of artwork, sculptures, yeah, industrial reproduction. So the artwork was not unique anymore. Yeah, everybody had the sculpture then in the living room. Everybody has a reproduction of Rembrandt in the living room. This changed the art truly. Yeah, the change. Your job will change. That's, I think this is totally clear. And if you look at it as an augmentation of your talents, yeah, or as a replacement of your talents, I think this is your own decision in the end. Yeah, it's the old discussion, the starting history of,
I think that's fair.
It's augmentation, yeah, and replacement.
Alexander, you're absolutely right. You're actually skipping ahead to my conclusion on this, but you're right. You're absolutely right. I think AI is an evolution that we have to figure out and consider, and yeah. I was actually going to use photography as that example,
yeah.
I want people to understand a little bit about the technology that goes on behind AI before we get to that, because I think people need to understand that this is feeding a huge amount of data into a system, and then it learning on its own something and giving you an output. And the input and output is still like what it used to be in the old computers, except it's just a lot bigger and is smarter about the decision it's made.
Much simpler if you, for the people, it's much for their own mindset, it's much simpler to invent different terms and not talk about learning. The ambiguity is too strong. As sort of a child learns, aha, the light bulb moment is not happening. So it's a different process. We learned that with automated cars now the hard way, yeah, because our brain, we have, I think, 50 megabit or such input, nothing, yeah, and all these systems, they are eating data, gigabytes here, gigabits there. This is awful. It's obviously a completely different functioning model, yeah. So it's not learning. We invent another better world, training whatsoever. But we need different terms for that, because otherwise it's always so misleading.
That's why we use the term, you're training it, and then you're looking at the output of the model. but I don't tend to use the word learning for the same reasons. I'm just trying to separate the artificial intelligence, Hell 9000, you know, general purpose AI, sentience, singularity, and we throw a bunch of terms on that, which is, I think, incredibly cool, and I would love to be able to work with one someday. Back to the machine learning neural network that's employed, and I kind of see them as being orders of magnitude apart, but you know, in the same general family.
Well, the bulk of the individuals here aren't going to be creating neural networks.
No, what actually the, not. Well, I'm going to correct you on that. Scott created a neural network on his home computer.
I said the bulk. I didn't say everybody.
But he can tell you what he did and why it's possible.
I know. When he showed it to me, and it was beautiful.
Leave me out of this.
It's all you, Scott.
For all intents and purposes. I'm innocent. The bulk of the individuals in here are going to be, how many of you are 3D artists? Raise your hands. How many of you are working within the Adobe Creative Suite? How many of you are doing compositing work, editing work? Okay, so basically every single one of those companies, which you all know who they are, but to just keep things nice and clean, we won't say their names. Everybody at this particular moment in time from a technology M&E tools provider standpoint, everybody is exploring AI, and they're trying to figure out how best to implement it within their particular solutions. And actually, Peter had a really good point night before last, where he was talking about the amount of users that V-Ray has, and the amount of feedback that comes into the development teams from all these various individuals that are using that technology in a slightly different way. And they need that technology to do something slightly different. When you start looking at some of the really large 3D software packages, I think you guys can figure those out, it is becoming very complex to be able to navigate through all the capabilities within the software, where you've got 40 different ways to be able to model something. And you're going to go through 12 different menus. You've got a variety of different ways you can render things. The software is becoming so complex that it's now becoming a barrier between the artist and the art they're ultimately trying to create. What I am seeing on the AI front is a way of streamlining a lot of workflows, being able to build in a lot more productivity within the actual software, which ultimately equates into being able to do faster iterations. You can do greater number of iterations. Because right now, what everybody's probably running into is that you're being asked to deliver a lot more content, a lot more complexity of that content, and you're being asked to deliver it in less time, and you're being paid the same amount, or your budgets are decreasing. So there's a fundamental gap or a chasm between what your expectations are and ultimately the resources at hand. And what I'm seeing on the AI front, is it going to be the holy grail? No. At least not in the short term. But you can correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're spot on with that. I mean, I've used applications for more than 20 years in the industry, and it's been really nice to see the progression of how things have gone, you know, from the earlier, you know, Power Animator product all the way through to Maya, or, you know, in the Softimage XSI, as well as Prisms to Houdini and so on. And I'm excited about, you know, what's being, you know, made under the hood at you know, Foundry or SideFX and such, and Adobe as well. Well, let me mention all the companies. And the idea is, you know, yeah, they'll be on-prem and cloud native in terms of being able to talk to the object store, and they'll be, you know, they'll be offering, you know, greater machine learning capabilities. In my talk today, I talked about the idea of, you know, having a, you know, potentially a similar interface to the Google Assistant, for instance, or one of the other machine learning capable machines, and being able to ask it to do things. And what excited me about that was the idea of being able to have contextual awareness of what you're asking for. So you could say, you know, I want to start off with a biped, humanoid, and you get a rig for that because that's something that many people, you know, who here has written a script to rig a biped? Yes, please, thank you. There's like six hands that go up, and that's awesome. And that's, you know, everyone's got their different style on, you know, what color, if it's, you know, red for right or red on the left for international nautical terms. But sorry, there's a rowdy room outside. The bottom line though is that there's a whole bunch of tasks that I think that we can look at automating and get to a point where artists could hit the ground running with a character that might have anatomically correct muscles that automatically jiggle and have skin sliding over muscle and bone, and you just have to sit through and sculpt the outer shape and paint on some weights for how jiggly things should be. But just the idea of then training a neural net that can go through and say, well, based on what the character looks like from an anatomic standpoint, we're going to go through and actually have, we're going to apply these weights because for humanoids and quadrupeds, they typically have this structure, similar conceptually to some of the work you're doing.
Yeah.
Go.
I'm going to use that analogy, and I want to apologize. The guys over in the next room are doing the VR battles, and I told them they can be as loud as they want to be because this is THU, and I'm going to let that happen. So, if you guys can't hear, let me know, and My buddy over there is going to turn it up. You can't turn it up much louder. So we're cool. You're just going to have to listen. okay, but there's an interesting question there, right? Do you want to be an animator or do you want to be a director? Because you could just direct the animation through a neural network instead of animating it yourself.
So I remember working at a large CG company that I will not name, and there was basically a gating factor as part of the recruiting process. And if you came in and said, I'm an animator, but I want to direct, you were like not getting the job. If you came in and said, I'm an animator and I really want to emote and perform and breathe life into this character and I want to take direction and I want to be able to achieve the director's vision and bring this to the screen, I'm excited they just won. That was a better fit for the job, because if you don't look at the commercial art as commercial art, if you look at it as your own art, then you can run into some problems in terms of dailies and being able to actually take comments. And so, one of the attributes of some of the successful animators that I'm friends with are the fact that they can sit there and as soon as you start talking with them, they will open their notebook, and I'm not the one giving the notes, but when they get notes, they're writing down, yes, okay, you want this changed, and they understand and they take the notes and then they apply them because it's their job and they're professionals. It's their own work, in fact, where they want to be the director side. So to answer your question, not all of the animators that I know are on the directorial front, but the ones who are tend to do it on the side.
Okay.
I got to clap.
Okay. Hey, thank you, Henry.
all right. I want to address something else because it's very interesting to me, because most of AI is based on input-output, right? Most of the, in some case, you feed it a bunch of data and you get a bunch of data back. Now, most of what we have been feeding AI is either text or vision, sometimes audio, etc. But we have other senses, and I know that Sabine is into this. So how do you know of a way that senses can actually be perceived by humans that are, like, how sensitive are they? Or do you still need a judge to do that? Is there any way to sense something virtually?
Sense something virtually. So the basic understanding what everybody has to know is when we smell something, the first thing is an emotional decision. I like it or don't like it. Nothing else. We can't say intellectually, this has to be a good one or something else. It's just I like it or don't like it. And it's there is a connection to the memory. Every time we smell something new, it's connected with the memory. Is it a nice memory or a bad memory? So every, maybe lavender is for Europe is a good expression. My generation, the grandmothers used lavender perfume. And it depends if the grandmother was a nice one and gave you always chocolate and you could do whatever you want, then it's lavender a positive smell. But there are also sometimes with grandmas, yes, wet kisses or go early to sleep, and then it's a bad memory. And you can't change that. That's it. And this is for every cent and every people individual.
It's, so it's very individual.
There is nothing,
so
nothing
whatever,
really.
Whatever your grandmother wore as a perfume is going to impact you
for
the rest
every
of your
smell
life.
For everything you smell has an impact on your life.
And that is a very personal thing.
It is. Yes, that's
so
a difficult.
That is hard to say, I like that dress, I don't like that dress, because that is more of a group decision as opposed to what you just described.
With a dress, it's different because it's color, it's fashion, it's, yes.
Right, it's a group decision. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard, like, identifying your grandmother's, the smell of your grandmother is a personal thing.
Yeah.
You can't describe your grandmother's smell like, my grandmother smells like garlic and blueberries, right? Like, you can't, it's hard to describe that, right? So there's a smell that's hard to describe. And therefore, that's what I'm trying to get at, is there's a very personal input.
Yeah. For a dress, you can change, maybe. You can change over time also, that you say, as a young girl, as a teenager, I think this is kind of old-fashioned. 10 years later, you think, wow, that's my style. It's again in fashion, that's my style, now I like it. With a perfume or with a smell, it's not working. It's not changing over time because the memory sticks.
Right. Right.
So it's really kind of, you're stuck with this and you can't, that's the thing what Alexander mentioned in the beginning, a lot of people come to me and say, for the car, can't you make a perfume that everyone is happy and refreshed when he's driving or calming down? And I say, no, I can't. I really can't. There is one, the thing, one for one is the lavender calming down, for the other one he gets aggressive because of grandma or whatever. Also there is the point is how intense the smell is. So when we are stressed or hungry or something like that, our smelling goes down, we are not smelling that good. So there's so much in how we perceive the smell in the same way, the temperature, the humidity, all it depends on how I get the smell, how I experience the smell.
Right. It sounds extraordinarily personal.
It is, yes.
Right, which is very interesting. What about, Jeff, what do you think about machine learning and smell?
Well, I was just, I don't know that I have an opinion on the machine learning and smell part because of interface issues. lacking the Matrix plugin, my ability to... how are we quantifying and qualifying smell? You know, is there a spectrograph in terms of what the makeup is? Or when we were talking about it, I was brought back to my youth. I grew up flying remote control models with my dad, and at the time, glow fuel was the predominant power source. And pretty much everything's transitioned over to electric these days. But I bring up glow fuel because it's something that you don't normally encounter in the environment. It's a very specific mix for running in these little engines with glow. With glow. And I found, like, 20 years later, I went back to the field, and there were still a couple of these engines running, but most everything was electric. And when I smelled that, I was just amazed at how, you know, visceral that experience was. I was relaxed and calm, and I was in a happy place, and then I got this smell of it, and I was at a green field, and the planes were flying, and I knew I was going to have a great time, and I hadn't seen my dad in a while, and it was just this just amazing, you know, really intense experience of just, you know, reenactment for me. And I haven't experienced anything, you know, that I've never had anything else in my life that I'd spent time with that was then compartmentalized for such a long period of time. So in a horrendously roundabout way of not answering your question, I have no construct for be able to be able to discuss how I might analyze scent and then feed that into a model and then be able to evaluate it. Somehow the Futurama smelloscope is not available.
Okay. Yeah, I understand. But Rob, yes. I want to ask you something because there is something very specific that happened in technology that has exploded the concept of AI right now. And that is about the ability to train a system, to train the network. We talked about, yes. You know, train the network. Training a network involves a lot of hardware to make that happen.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So Jeff is one of the best individuals to talk about the hardware required for training. But I mean, there's typically two different ways of doing, whether it's within a sandbox where it's going to be within, you know, a typical workstation type of scenario where you can stack it full of GPUs.
Or well, that's the key, right? The key is GPUs. The key is being able to, GPUs have been the ability, have made the training process faster.
It actually, GPUs made the training process possible.
Possible, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, so. So yeah, I mean, whether or not you're doing something that's client-based, whether it's underneath your desk, so it's just basically a workstation with a whole stack of whatever, Titan cards, TI cards, Quadra cards, you know, GV cards, whatever they might be, or you, you know, go out to a cloud-based solution where you can just harness an insane amount of calculation capabilities out there, so. And like I said, actually, Jeff might be a little bit more attuned to be able to answer that question.
Well, I think you've answered it well. I don't want to be overly commercial here. I guess what I'm excited about is, you know, with TensorFlow, for instance, it's open source. So if you want to run it on your laptop, if you want to run it on a desktop workstation, if you want to run it in our cloud or someone else's cloud, that's totally an option. You can train on CPU or GPU, and you can also train on TPU. So that's an exciting thing too. So there's a variety of options to the end user, depending what you want to do.
Okay, I know I'm running a little bit long. I'm sorry. We went into this whole little philosophical discussion at the beginning, but I want people to understand a little bit about what we're talking about. Basically, what we're talking about is training a system to do something. You guys are aware of that idea. What that system can do is very interesting. Paul's got a question. Go ahead, Paul.
So just exactly on that point, right now we've seen that machine learning, you can train it with a bunch of paintings by a particular painter, you can give it a photo, it'll transform that photo into something that to a lot of people would look like it was painted by that painter. I mean, that kind of blows you away, right? How far will this continue? Where will it stop? At some point, could you take the script for a movie,
yes.
Send that in, it outputs the movie. At some point, do you just ask for a movie and it outputs a movie? Are we going there?
Those data, all that analytical data is already being captured in droves. I mean, how many people here have Netflix? How many people have Hulu? They can tell you exactly how much you watch, what genre you watch, all the actors that you normally gravitate toward. If you stop at a particular moment, what you prefer as far as the duration of the movie, whether or not you fast forward through a certain part of the movie. So, I mean, there is so much data on just specifically you, but just everybody in general, where it's not out of the realm of reality, where, you know, I'm not going to say that movie studios are soulless, but they're in business to stay in business and make a profit. And before they make a film, they have already got a document. And before they've even done anything, they've got a script, they've got this document, and they can go through and project pretty damn close, in most cases, exactly how much money, how much revenue that film is going to generate. Okay, now factor in all this viewing data that they've got ready access to right now. Now they've got more of a recipe card as to what kind of film to make, where it's going to be lots of robots and superheroes, and you know there'll be a romantic comedy thrown in here and there for good measure, you know. But there is the possibility that you will see, you know, some of these films where they're not—I wouldn't say scripted, but as far as like the overall story. And I use that term very loosely, being generated through AI. Just
okay.
Because the sheer volumes of data.
Maybe premise.
Hold on.
The premise. Okay. I'm not saying the actual the scripts and whatnot.
I don't want to say too much, but like I feel like there are things that are computationally intractable for the foreseeable future, like things that are like looking at like natural language models, like they can barely remember a sentence or a paragraph at the most, and that's running at the limit of what we can do computationally, and to put the nuance to generate a script for a 2-hour film with dialogue and empathy, you know, it's intractable, in my opinion. My humble opinion, for the foreseeable future.
A recipe, a premise.
Yeah. You've been describing like the Netflix scenario that's like make a movie for me, that makes everyone here feel like they're out of a job, right?
No.
In a lot of ways. But hold on, wait, hold on. But that's the thing. But what I saw this week, you know, hanging out with Scott, I know you're shaking your head, but what I saw was amazing, and
it's beautiful, but it's
completely driven by AI, but at the same time it's driven by you. There's an input output scenario that still makes it you, and it work.
I'm orchestrating it, right? So, in the simple terms, like I've just trained a tool, and you could call it AI, probably machine learning is much better, right? A very restricted view of it. It's just transforming images, right? And I have a particular intent when I'm doing that, and I am curating the data that I'm putting into it, and I'm orchestrating the output. The little black box, you know, is sophisticated, but is not thinking, is not feeling, is doing my bidding. Entirely.
Absolutely.
And this is probably beyond most people, it's deterministic, right? If I give it the same thing twice, the same exact input twice, it would give me the same exact output twice. So it's deterministic. So it's a piece of software, really. Like it's sophisticated and it's deep, the deep neural network part, and it's been trained a lot. I mean, it's been baked for like over a month.
It's been
right?
keeping your house warm.
It's been keeping it. Yeah. I mean, I need to check my electricity bill. but so that's it. Like there are creative possibilities when you just understand how the tools work. Right.
So what I want to get at specifically, what I was trying to get at, is that what you've discovered is that AI is a tool not just for simplifying your choices, but also for thinking of something new.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think back to maybe the early 80s, if you were an architect and you did your drawings on paper or you made models with foam, that was kind of your way to visualize, right? But there's all of a sudden we had 3D, we had silicon graphics, we had the ability to generate structures, and this whole process of form finding became digital, and we were able to explore a lot of possibilities that you couldn't draw on paper, you couldn't build a model for it, and we had an explosion in architecture where we have these amazing structures that were enabled by this little step in possibility with our technology. And that's what my feeling is, that's what machine learning and maybe AI will give us, is that step where more creative things will be possible.
Yeah. Right.
And Chris, can I unpack Paul's statement for just a moment?
Absolutely.
Okay. So there's a tool that shall remain nameless, but you can throw in dialogue and it will put in two characters and it'll use a standard 3-camera setup because that's what it's been trained. So it'll show you the two characters and cut between character A and character B. It's like an episode of Three's Company. And you'll actually get the dialogue back and forth, and it's a synthesized voice, and you get your movie. And so if you just start you know, extrapolating from there, and we can say, well, let's look at, you know, Tom Cruise movies where he's got this move and there's an explosion and he's running along and they overcrank the camera for slow motion. And then you do the Hitchcock camera move where you've got the whole zoom rack focus look and you really build this nice little repertoire of greatest camera moves and you grab some Pixar layout and rule of thirds and golden mean and you slam it all together from a composition standpoint and you could make a derivative tool that would execute a movie. But it would be an effort that was sort of a culmination of human filmmaking. So I think that's, you know, and of course you can increase the shading on the models and have a repertoire, and if there was enough detail in the script, I mean, we're just talking about a sliding scale along, you know, we're talking like PlayStation 1 graphics to, you know, Xbox, you know, wherever we are, and PlayStation 12, and, you know, you move it along. So I think we could get something out of it. I think it would pale in comparison to any of the human crafted films that we have at this point. Someday in that distant future of artificial intelligence, when you have potentially consciousness, then that's a whole different animal. But in today's machine learning land, I think you're essentially just building a better version of the tool that I started with. What are your thoughts, Paul?
Sorry.
You were emoting, so I wanted to...
Well, if I ever made a movie and the reviews were a culmination of human filmmaking, I mean, that would be good, I think. Yeah. I was thinking more of instead of, you know, having like just algorithms that like physically put rigs of characters there and then animate their faces like we've seen 5 years ago. I mean, these machine learning algorithms can just put pixel values out on the screen.
Okay.
And so it's possible that they could create the appearance of characters, of humans, of environments, without there even being any explicit rig or anything like that. Just that, you know, when it simulates something that's supposed to look like a Rembrandt painting, it's not necessarily thinking specifically in terms of brushstrokes. It just has seen lots of brushstrokes, and it just creates those because it makes things that happen to look like what it's seen before. These machine learning algorithms, you could give it the entire Netflix library. You could give it everything that's been on YouTube. You could give it every image that's on the internet, much more than any of us have ever been exposed to. And theoretically, you know, a few more Moore's laws, maybe it can just generate the imagery and it will surprise us by the fact that it actually created people and motion and sounds as well that make up a scene of a movie, maybe.
So I have two questions for you. When and is your lab working on this?
Well, not specifically working on that problem, but that's the question that I'm kind of asking the panel is like, when and is this going to happen? And there's people here in the audience who will be, you know, working, you know, professionally 50 years from now. What's it going to be like then to be creative?
Well, we have a futurist right here.
Lucky for us. Yeah, I think that's not so difficult to answer as it seems, yeah? Because if you have machine learning technology, in my point of view, it's a kind of leveling out already, conceptual. Because it will not become conscious, it will become perfect tool for so many things, yeah? But no, it will not start to... If you have Terminator 1, yeah? Very cool. Terminator 2 could be made by advanced machine learning in 20 years, yeah? Because it was totally boring, marketing-driven. Terminator 3, 4, 1, 1,500, you can do that, yeah? But to have make a new thing like that, yeah? This would be, I don't believe that in anyhow with machine learning, yeah, with machine training, you have to train that. That's passive data. But on the other hand, what I was going to say, because everybody's talking about jobs and so on, augmentation sounds nice, but the truth is you have to see, everybody has to see, that it will make, you have described it perfectly, it will make your work very much more efficient. Efficient sounds nice, but efficient always also means one, you are much faster, you cannot hide yourself in stupid jobs, yeah? No? Like photography and painting in oil, yeah? That can take months. Photography, it's in an instant, nearly, it is there. So it is. It puts it. You have to develop your talents in a different way. A recommendation is make yourself a sheet of paper and put on the right side what would you want to automate from your talents and your work? And on the left side, what would you not to automate? What would you like to develop, to learn? But that's for everybody should do that on its own. And then you
Alexander,
are on the right
I want to use your photography example specifically because I think it's important. And we had the digital human stuff that happened last night. Ian Spriggs talks a lot about photography in terms of not portraiture, right? We used to paint portraits. We painted portraits to remember the people that were in our past. Yeah, and then we replaced that with photography, right? Mm-hmm. And then photography, quote unquote, killed painting.
Killed something.
It killed painting. It did not kill painting.
It was revived.
It did not kill painting because now everyone takes a photograph of themselves 16 times a day with selfies or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. They're constantly photographing themselves. So photography or self-portraiture or whatever it is constantly there. Yeah. So and Jeff is taking a picture of you right now, so you are now our portrait. So the fact is that painting was not replaced by photography. Painting became something else.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. But then you are as an artist, maybe your livelihood was sitting there and make portraits, yeah?
Right.
Yeah. Then that was, after a decade or so, gone. And you were forced, as a painter then, as a portrait painter, you were forced to think about painting and do something else, invent something else, yeah?
All have to evolve.
Yeah.
And evolution is part of this whole process, and I think that artificial intelligence is going to be part of the evolution that we deal with. And the art form that I saw from Scott, I know you're thinking it's very simple, and you're right what you're saying, but it gave me hope. It gave me hope to think that artistry can evolve out of wonderful things that you did, and it's not just about making your life simpler. It made something more beautiful.
To think it makes your world simpler is absolutely wrong. It makes your world much more eventful. Yeah, because the simple things are this we are doing routinely. Yeah, make a blue circle. Can do it every day. But now that you can automate. Even today you can make a blue circle very fast. So it's not simpler. Simple would be repetitive tasks. But if you look in your table, what's to automate, then all the repetitive tasks should be there, the boring tasks should be there, and on the other hand, what's not to automate, the more exciting tasks, but exciting means it's an effort, it's not simple.
It's an effort. Well, art is an effort. Art is struggle, art is something that you need to do.
That's what I want to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So
this gentleman here had a quick question.
Yes.
Richard.
Oh, sorry.
What I keep hearing here is that we want to automate all of the mundane tasks. We want to make it easier to get into where we want to go and all of that, which is super cool to me. But for all of the upcoming juniors who used to do all of the in-betweens, who used to do all of the upcoming work, where does this bring us in the future? Do we no longer need the juniors to learn and to get to where we want to go? Where are we going with this?
May I? So from a junior standpoint, I mean, as you, if you go back and look, we keep talking about Terminator 2 tonight, for instance, and I talked with the people who did the production on that on that show, and it was just horrendously laborious to do some of the things. Like, they were editing the envelope waiting on the character in a text file in VI. You know, it was one of those conversations. And, you know, now you're in Maya and you're painting the envelope. And that's just an example of, you know, erasing the mundane from one's life. But there's still a job for someone to go through and do blend shapes for the shoulder position in all different extremes. I don't see any of the junior jobs going away. I just see the junior jobs getting better. I mean, I've been sitting here thinking, wow, you know, I've spent 20 years in the industry. How awesome would it be to be starting now? Like, when I hope everyone really, my Nana always said, you can't put an old head on young shoulders. So no matter how much we sit here and pontificate about how amazing things are for you today, it's difficult for, you know, you beyond nodding, for you to really potentially say, yeah, it used to suck and now it's better, because there's still parts of it that are difficult and challenging. And hopefully in the next, and I raise my voice and see if this works, hopefully in the next, you know, revision of software, you know, maybe in the next kind of 5 to 7 years perhaps, we'll be in a scenario where we get a kind of a fresh cycle of you know, like they'll still be similar packages to what you use today and they'll still look very similar, but perhaps the engines underneath will change. But the bottom line is, I still think there's a place for juniors to start and to excel, and I think the work will just be more interesting. The volume of what you can handle, like, you know, imagine having animators do crowd simulations and stuff as part of the hero animation, be able to visualize that, and you know, and some of the voice interface I was talking about may come true, and you know, the idea of deep compositors being able to do that in real time, like it used to be on a Flame or an Inferno. I mean, not having to send it to the farm. I mean, just the idea of not having to waste time as a human waiting to be able to get results, you know, renders that happen almost immediately, make it a spectator sport. You could final a shot with the director sitting with you. That's not always practical from a time and telepresence standpoint, but I think all of that is technically possible. It's more of an execution problem right now. We have the compute, we have the talent, but it just, it's going to take time to put all that together and make that into a production tool. And at the same time, some social engineering will be required on the production side for supervision and production and leads, as well as artists to be able to transition to new workflows and still be competitive in the film market and hit the deadlines.
Thank you, Jeff. That was good. We have another question. Go ahead, Jasper.
So I was just kind of wondering, like, will AI eventually affect the relevance of artists in general to society? Like, I'm talking more about, like, what will AI art, for example, mean to the average person? Like, once you start seeing, like, AI art made in an art gallery or something, for example, like, if that person thinks that's good enough, like, are we really as relevant anymore if someone else is thinking, like, some people might just go to see art as a pretty picture or something like that. They go to where we might go and look at it to go and see the history behind it, or it has more relevance to our community. But so do you kind of get what I mean with that? But
you're talking about AI art, right? So art created by a computer.
I understood the question differently. If you look back to the 1900, for example, there, then everything got ornamental because it was, people could do it. And before ornament, the tapestry, everything on the wall, yeah, was done by highly paid artists, and only in the very rich people had that. Aristocracy had that. And then it was people were able to print that as wallpaper, put it on the wall. And after a while, it was absolutely awful because everything was totally ornamented because it was cheap. And the same thing will happen, I'm quite sure, if you have machine-generated art, yeah, in this way, yeah, and the people will fill everything up with that. Yeah, you will see everything Rembrandt-ized. Yeah, every style will be replicated. You will have Terminator 1200. The series, and it will be awful. I think the sex industry, porn industry will start, yeah, because that's all sports, same thing, yeah, very replicative. And you will have that everywhere, and afterwards there will come a movement like the Bauhaus, clean it all up. Yeah, but that's a cycle, I guess, because first of all, people will see, hey, that looks so cool. Yeah, it's like true art in the gallery for $10,000, I can have it. I printed off of my computer, very cool. So you will have that everywhere. But after a while, the people will get fed up, and the avant-garde will tell you, okay, this is not art, this is fakeware, you don't do that, please, and so on. Like the ornaments.
Okay, I love what you just said. It's like fakeware, right?
Huh?
Like, it's fakeware.
It's fakeware.
Right? Yeah. And that's a legitimate argument. Yeah. Fakeware actually could work. Fakeware could be practical.
Yeah, people will use that, like Terminator 2. And
yeah, because I could use some fakeware to deal with all the mundane tasks that I have to do as a visual effects artist, right?
Yeah, but after a while, people visiting you will say, okay, what's this guy had? What is he in his walls?
So what? The movie still has to get made.
Huh?
The movie still has to get made.
No, the people will...
But I'm not trying to make art, I'm trying to make a movie.
You will find, for example, these fake were advertisements, and there will be cheap advertisements, and that's it. And you have these, like you have digital domain stuff, which is totally high-end, yeah? And people will develop a new high-end, which will be very expensive with productivity tools we don't know today, yeah? But we will have this basic level, we will find that, and this will be awful.
Okay.
However, I
appreciate that, Alexander. Unfortunately, because of the craziness of the battles going on right now, and it's getting a little loud, I think we're going to have to cut this a little bit short. But I think there's been some interesting discussions. Have you guys, has this been useful? Has this been good to you guys? Do you like it? All right, thanks, guys. This has been the last talk. I feel like we could go another good 2-3 hours into this discussion because this is really what is our future. I think 2000, in the last 2 years and the next 20 years is going to be defined by the things that have happened to us right now. And I really think that this is going to be what we're going to be dealing with. And we all need to think about this in terms of what it means for our lives and where we can take advantage of it and where we can basically watch the perils that are involved. So thank you so much for joining us, guys.
Thanks.